Auschwitz is it's a bad thing. Chapter 6, On the Death Train. I don't remember, Marion said, how we covered the distance of 3 to 4 miles to the railroad loading platform at the town of Belson. I am sure that, weak as he was, Papa must have carried me. Albert, of course, would have shouldered as many of our belongings as he could, as well as the knapsack in which he always managed to have at least a crust of bread or raw turnip to share with the rest of us. Mama, too, carried a knapsack with personal belongings, precious documents, receipts, letters, and mementos, including our old family photographs. One good thing about the evacuation from Bergen-Belsen, frightening as it was that we were allowed to be reunited as a family and to remain that way. The train that awaited the Blumenthals and their fellow prisoners had recently emptied itself of other prisoners who had been transported to Bergen-Belsen from the east. In fact, the ragged, hollow-eyed groups actually passed each other on foot, moving in opposite directions. Later, the 2,500 Belsen evacuees learned that they were the last of the three groups to leave the camp. The balance of the 8,000 evacuees had departed earlier, starting on April 6th. The first group had been taken to the concentration camp of Theresienstadt, or Terezin, in Czechoslovakia, which was liberated by the Soviet Army units on May 8, 1945. The second group had been shunted back and forth across north-central Germany until it was liberated by American troops near Magdeburg, a short distance to the east of Bergen-Belsen. The occupants of the third train were not so fortunate. As bad as Bergen-Belsen was, we were terrified to be going on transport to what seemed like almost certain death. Why would the Germans want to empty the Sternlager so near to the end of the war? Was it because they had so many exchange Jews in the camp who had never been sent to Palestine? We were the evidence of their broken promises to the International Red Cross. Was that why they wanted to have us destroyed before the Allies arrived and learned the truth? As ordered, the prisoners climbed into the boxcars. At first, with only about 50 people to a car, there was room to spread out and arrange themselves in their new quarters. It was agreed that the pail of drinking water and the toilet bucket would be kept as far apart as possible, at diagonal opposite ends of the cars. The prisoners now waited for the doors to be slid shut and bolted from the outside, and for the train to start rolling, but oddly, nothing happened. The day was warm and sunny, and soon some of the bolder evacuees ventured down from the cars. A pile of rotting rutabagas, the turnpike vegetables that made up much of the camp fare, lay near the platform. People began to sort through them for those that were the least odorous. Some even wandered into a nearby stream and began to bathe. Surprisingly, the SS guards, who were posted around the loading area, made no attempt to drive the prisoners back into the cars. They didn't even shout a warning, Ruth said. So why didn't any of us make a run for it? We couldn't, because we had a child with a serious leg wound. But some of the others might have made it into the dark pine forest beyond the loading ramp. The answer, surely, was that no matter where we hid, we would still be surrounded by Nazi Germany. So close to defeat, the country would be more dangerous than ever for an escaped Jewish prisoner, so there was still no place to run. All that day, the train remained at the siding, its doors wide open. By early evening, the prisoners had begun to build fires of dried twigs alongside the railroad track, and to cook soups with half-rotted rutabagas and any other roots or herbs they had managed to dig up. Then, as darkness fell, they were headed back into the cars, the doors were bolted, and they awaited the start of the journey to an unknown destination. So why do you think they're not moving them anywhere? Why do you think they're just keeping them in the cars? They're keeping them close to the cars. Okay, so they don't run off. But why not keep them in the camp? Why would you move them to the cars and keep them in the cars? What's happening in Germany right now, at the time this book is being written? Germany winning the war or losing the war? They said that the prisoners in a couple of camps had already been freed. Is Germany winning or losing the war? Who has the people prisoner? Who has put all these Jews in the concentration camps? The Nazis from what country? Germany. So if people are if the German prisoners are being freed, are the Germans winning the war? No. So why would they put their prisoners on a train? Again, what's happening at the other camps? What's happening to the prisoners? No. At this point, no. Germany's losing the war. What's happening to their prisoners? They're being freed. What is a bonus of having everybody on a train? What could you do at a minute's notice? Remember, all these people are starving. Can you make them run at gunpoint with you? What's a bonus of having them all on trains? The train isn't moving. The train is just sitting there. But what could they do with the train? Is it easy to make a whole camp of people disappear?
Yes.
How? What have they done that makes it easy to make a whole camp disappear? They put them on a train. They didn't stop the train. They've got the train just sitting there. What can they do? The other troops come from this way. What do they do with the train? If the people are coming from this way, what direction do they send the train? If the people are coming from this way, what way can they send the train? They send it away from the people that are invading. So because these people are on the train, are they easy to move at a moment's notice? You keep them in the cars, you lock the cars at night. Can they be moved quickly if you need to? Absolutely. Is it possible? Is it a good thing for the Blumenthals that they could be moved? Really? People in the camps are being freed because they found the camps. Is it likely that they're going to find the Blumenthals quickly? If they're on a moving train? It's easy to find a moving train? No. So that's a bad thing for them. After a fitful night, the prisoners awoke to find themselves still standing at the Bergen Railroad siding. The train had not moved. It was now April 10th, another pleasant spring day. The routine was much like that of the day before, except the additional prisoners from Bergen-Belsen straggled toward the train and entered the boxcars. Instead of 50 people, each car now held 70 to 80. Also, bread was distributed to the prisoners, a large chunk that they were told must last them 8 days. Late that night, its doors shut and bolted, the train at last began to move. The next morning, with the train having traveled only about 15 miles north of Bergen, it halted and the doors were unbolted. As the SS guard slid them open, they called into each car, "Toten raus! Out with the dead!" Already, several cases of typhus had developed on the train, for many of the prisoners had been incubating the disease while still in Bergen-Belsen. The 2-week incubation period began with the bite of a louse that carried the typhus germ. No symptoms showed until deep pink pea-sized spots appeared around the midriff. This rash had given the disease the common name of spotted fever. Its onset was accompanied by a severe headache and a high fever that often resulted in delirious ravings and hallucinations. Death usually followed within 1 to 2 days. If, however, the patient survived past the 12th day, it was believed that there was a good chance of recovering. This cry of "Toten raus," Mama said, was repeated throughout the trip as more and more people fell victim of the disease. We prisoners had to bring out our dead. Then the SS would give us pickaxes and shovels to dig a shallow pit alongside the railroad track while they stood guard over us. We buried our loved ones, covered over the mass grave, and there we left them. One especially pitiful burial was that of a little boy, only 7 or 8 years old, who was the son of a heavyset Greek Jew named Albala. Albala had been our head capo in Bergen-Belsen, and he was hated by all of us. He never failed to give us that extra measure of cruelty when the German command was around to observe him in action. For these cruelties to us, he received special favors and privileges from the Germans. But that day, as I watched him place his child's lifeless body alongside the track, I thought, no, not even he, that hated Albala, deserves such a sorrow. The mounting deaths from typhus gave the death train its name, but the killer disease was only one of its scourges. Almost everyone suffered from dysentery, and many were unable to wait for the train's frequent stops to relieve themselves. Others were too weak to crawl down from the cars, so the latrine buckets overflowed and the cars became open sewers. The passengers were ill, too, with pleurisy and tuberculosis, diseases that spread easily when people coughed or spit. And many had wounds that, like Marion's, failed to heal. It was impossible, Marion said, to keep the large burned area of my leg clean. It continued to ooze pus and was attacked by lice that I removed one by one and destroyed. Many people shaved their heads to be rid of the lice that we had carried with us from camp, and that were surely on the train as well when we boarded it, but I begged Mama not to shave mine. So she carefully combed out the head lice several times a day, as she had done in Bergen-Belsen. By April 15th, the slow-moving train had traveled only as far as Lüneburg, about 50 miles northeast of Bergen. Often it stopped during the day in wooded areas to hide from the Allied aircraft that flew overhead. Although the Germans attached a white flag to the train, the Allies had no idea of the innocent cargo it carried. Dive bombings and strafings with machine guns continued, and sometimes the train was even caught in artillery crossfire. If the attacks came by day, the train stopped, and if the doors opened, those who could run sought cover in nearby ditches. During night attacks, the cars remained sealed, and the prisoners could only huddle in their places and hope for the best. A few days later, the train crossed the Elbe River, heading in an easterly and then southeasterly direction. Soon after, it had reached the far side of the river. The bridge on which it had traveled was blown up by Allied bombers. The train was now in a zone between the Western Allies and the Russians. It was, in fact, headed toward Berlin, the German capital, where Hitler still held out. By this time, Ruth reported, so many had died of typhus that we were once again able to find a little room for ourselves in the cars. Our bread and water were long since gone, but the great number of stops made it possible for us to dig some potatoes, beets, and other root vegetables from the edges of the fields. Water for drinking was our main problem. Some people drank from creeks and streams along the tracks, but this was dangerous, for it could lead to severe diarrhea. So when the train stopped, I went up front to the locomotive and begged water from the German engineer. He did me a great kindness in letting me have as much water as I had vessels for. The water came from the steam locomotive itself and was hot and rusty, but at least it was safe for us to drink. After 1 week on the train, the prisoners came in sight of the bombed-out capital of Berlin. Because of the extensive damage to the railway lines, it took 2 days to cross the city. The train had to stop frequently to be backed up and rerouted wherever there were broken tracks, derailed cars, disabled locomotives, or heaps of rubble. The buildings that still stood appeared as weird silhouettes against the sky. These sights, Marion said, all told us that the war must be coming to an end. Yet the Germans insisted on moving us onward along what was left of their railway system. It was senseless for them to do this, and it was terrifying to us. We could only conclude that they were determined to kill us, even in the midst of their own death throes. After Berlin, the train continued in a southerly direction, traveling almost parallel with the Polish border. The area had once been a rich farming belt. Although it now suffered from wartime shortages, the prisoners found it possible to obtain occasional handouts of bread and potatoes. An almost friendly SS man would accompany the groups of food seekers to a farmhouse door and wait there while they tried their luck. Gradually, the prisoners noticed that another favorable development was taking place. Some of the farmhouses had recently been abandoned. The German farm population was fleeing the area, a sure sign that the Russians approaching from the east must be close at hand. "We were so ill and weak," Ruth said, "skeletons, all of us, that we hardly realized what was happening. The train had become our home. We crouched there like sick animals, sleeping, eating whatever we had, delousing ourselves and our clothing. Then one morning, very early, the doors were slid open. Men in uniforms sprang aboard, but they were not the SS. They spoke roughly in a strange accent, saying over and over again a word that sounded like the German for watch, Uhr. Some already had their arms full of wristwatches. Only a few of us had anything to give them, for we had long since bartered away everything we had for food. But they were good-natured about it, and when we looked out the doors of the train, we saw that there were other Russian soldiers like them marching alongside the track. They were leading away, as prisoners, our SS guards, or at least those SS who had not managed to escape during the night. We knew then that after 6.5 years, this was the day of our liberation from the Nazis. It was exactly 2 weeks since we had boarded the death train in Bergen-Belsen. The date was April 23rd, 1945.